Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review of Wednesday, September 21st, 2016. We'll start with an article on the front page. Process to create Amish Museum gets into motion in Arthur by Tony Reed, H&R staff writer. Arthur, Amish history, propelled by horsepower, set off toward the future Tuesday morning. A team of 8 hulking Belgian plow horses was hitched up to a trailer and, after a couple of false starts, began moving the circa 1866 Moses Yoder farmhouse at a surprisingly brisk clip-clop. "This is my first house pull," said Amish farmer Eldon Schrock, who helped supply the horses while his farming assistant, Stephen Hostetler, controlled the reins. "But it's not our first rodeo," added Hostetler, who made handling the straining equine muscle look easy. The horses only towed the 2-story wood house a symbolic distance across the big parking lot near Yoder's Kitchen Restaurant, creating a poignant photo op, before the more concentrated horsepower of a diesel truck took over. And trucks from Farmington-based Bologna House Moving, Inc., also were on hand, right behind the Yoder farmhouse, to move the Daniel Schrock house, another 2-story farmhouse that dates to 1882. Both buildings, with police escort, were beginning a 3-mile, hour-long journey to a site carved out of farm fields west of Chesterville, where they will form part of the new Illinois Amish Museum and Heritage Center. Due to be open by the summer of 2017, it will showcase and preserve an island in time of Amish farm history and culture from yesteryear. Irvin Yoder is the great-great-grandson of Moses Yoder and was born in the farmhouse, billed as the oldest Amish home in Illinois. A successful businessman who is now a member of the Mennonite Church, he says both houses will be restored to their 19th century prime and offer visitors a window into a culture that fights change but cannot always resist it. "Amish live the old-fashioned way and live a simple life," said Yoder, 80. "But it's not near as simple as it was when I was very young." Yoder is vice president of the Illinois Amish Preservation Foundation Board of Directors, which is creating the Museum and Heritage Center. He said the farmhouses have sat in storage since 1999, waiting for a permanent location. They were going to be part of the Rockholm Gardens complex until that was taken over and turned into a wildlife park. Rockholm's transformation also meant an Amish museum and heritage center housed there became homeless too, and its many artifacts were also put into storage. The solution and permanent address for everything will be the new museum and heritage center near Chesterville. Sitting on 2.5 acres with the option to acquire more, it will house both farmhouses and a 10,000 square foot museum building yet to be built. A preserved Amish school, barn, and workshop will be among the site's other attractions in a project that is expected to cost at least $1.5 million. And with the state's tourism funds left lying fallow amid a budget crisis that never seems to end, the Amish project backers know they are on their own. They have already raised more than $100,000, but that money and more is spoken for as the cost to restore the 2 farmhouses to their 19th century splendor is expected to cost $250,000 alone. Wilmer Otto, president of the board of directors, has an abiding faith the money will be harvested. "We have been very gratified by the commitment and the donations we have already gotten," said Otto, 68. "I think getting the houses out there and restored will establish there is actually going to be a project, and then more people will help us." Bob Doan, community development director with the Arthur Area Economic Development Corporation, said the project is also going to help the local economy. "Tourists," he says, never lose their fascination with an Amish culture that says no to a lot of things we hold dear, but never seems to make us happy. The Amish go by the Bible, and that is what their culture is based on, he said. The admiration and respect I have for them is that it's a daily, 24/7, 365-day-a-year thing with them. To help, want to contribute to the Illinois Amish Museum and Heritage Center? Checks made out to the center can be sent to 283 Elim, E-L-I-M, Springs Park, Sullivan, Illinois, 61951. Rauner Takes Case to Internet, by Dan Petrella, H&R Springfield Bureau Chief. Springfield. In many ways, Governor Bruce Rauner's question and answer session Tuesday had the feel of a typical news conference. The first-term governor made an announcement, in this case, the appointment of an executive director to oversee Illinois' 2018 bicentennial celebration, and followed it up by fielding questions, often steering the answers back to some of his go-to subjects. The burden of high property taxes, the need for better funding and relief from state mandates for local schools, and the importance of term limits and legislative redistricting reform to restoring faith in state government. But rather than standing in front of a bank of TV cameras and a half dozen reporters, Rauner was seated in front of a webcam in his Capitol office, addressing a few hundred viewers on Facebook Live. It was the governor's first use of the live streaming service, which became available to all Facebook users this spring, and he promised more to come. The event allowed Rauner to bypass the traditional media to speak directly with the audience. Experts say it's a strategy that brings both potential benefits and possible pitfalls for someone facing low approval ratings. Nathan Carpenter, Assistant Director of Convergent Media at the Illinois State University School of Communication, said holding an event such as this sends a signal that Rauner doesn't feel his message is getting across to the public, and that he's not getting the kind of news coverage he'd like. You don't have to look far for evidence to support that assessment. During a July conversation with the editorial board of the Champaign News Gazette, Rauner vented his frustration with what he sees as the news media's failure to convey his message about his turnaround agenda to the public. I underestimated how much most of the standard media just doesn't care about this and ignores it and won't send our message out, he told the newspaper. We've been too slow in creating our own media channels through social media and other outlets. We're doing that now. Carpenter said one benefit for Rauner in doing such things as answering questions from the public on Facebook is that it creates an image of transparency and draws a stark contrast with his chief political rival, Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan, a Chicago Democrat with no social media presence to speak of. But that's also where the potential pitfalls come in, Carpenter said. Because the questions were submitted ahead of time and screened by Rauner's staff, it can prompt criticisms about the authenticity of the exchange, he said. The purpose of live streaming technology is to feed off of the audience, Carpenter said, but as Rauner responded to the pre-submitted questions, comments, and questions posted in real time went unaddressed. In this case, it becomes just another broadcasting tool, he said. And if you run counter to people's expectations with how the medium works, or counter to what are the norms for the medium, you can really turn off and frustrate a lot of users. Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, said efforts such as this are an extension of the bully pulpit that comes with the governor's office. Anything he does is going to get covered, Mooney said. the governor, especially in the state of Illinois, is a big deal. As for the format, Mooney said it would be a risky proposition for most politicians or public figures to field unanswered questions from an audience in real time. Pope Francis could be flustered if he got the wrong question, he said. Richland looks ahead to future carbon storage research by Chris Lusvardi, H&R staff writer. Decatur. After finding early success with its partnerships to study carbon sequestration, Richland Community College is looking ahead to long-term possibilities for the technology. Richland is among the partners looking into the business side of carbon storage through the Carbon Safe Project, said David Larick, director of Richland's sequestration program. Larick, who presented Tuesday during the Richland Board of Trustees meeting, is encouraged by the progress being made in the college's carbon capture and storage program. We really started with a blank sheet in writing the courses, Larick said. Students in the program have strong job possibilities, along with being able to advance and study at places including the University of Illinois and Millikan University, Larick said. A new agreement will allow for Millikan Environmental Studies students to take the Introduction and Advanced Carbon Sequestration courses offered at Richland, he said. Injection of carbon dioxide as part of the Industrial Carbon Capture and Storage Project is likely to begin in early 2017, Larick said. Injection wells are on or near the Richland campus, he said. The intent of that project is to capture a total of 5.5 million metric tons over 5 years. Developing the business side of the technology is what will increasingly become the focus of research, Larick said. The Carbon Safe Project is looking to identify long-term storage locations for carbon dioxide, said Doug Brower, Richland Vice President of Economic Development and Innovative Solutions. The Mount Simon Sandstone, where the carbon dioxide injection and storage has been tested underneath Decatur, is among what has been identified as one of the best-suited possibilities, Brower said. There is a great interest in seeing the establishment of an enterprise in the Decatur area to store carbon dioxide, Brower said. The likely partnership would involve Richland along with the Decatur Park District and City of Decatur, Brower said. The Illinois State Geological Survey and Archer Daniels Midland Company earlier this year approached the Decatur Park Board about the carbon safe research to determine whether Decatur is feasible for large-scale carbon storage. Property incorporated into the project could belong to the Park District. The aim is to have a carbon capture and storage complex built and permitted for operation in 2025. Carbon Safe would produce a commercial-scale facility that could store more than 50 million metric tons. Larick said carbon capture and storage is just one of the forms of alternative energy being studied at Richland. We're looking at demonstrating all sources, Larick said. BAUM students, police share breakfast conversation by Valerie Wells, H&R staff writer, Decatur. The first thing kindergartners at BAUM school learned on Tuesday morning is what kind of cereal a police officer likes best. My girls and I like Apple Jacks, Officer Justin Closen said in answer to a question from a curious student. That sort of question might not have been quite what Closen expected when he told the kids they could ask him anything they wanted to know. BAUM social worker Nicole Eckes is Officer Jason Danner's sister, and the siblings came up with the idea of having police officers visit the school to spend time with kids in a relaxed, informal setting and let them see that police officers aren't scary. She kind of came to me, and they were looking for a way to improve the relationship the students have with law enforcement and police. We decided we'd come in once a month and sit and talk with them and have breakfast. and try to change the way they feel about police and law enforcement in general. One of the children in the classroom Danner visited was actually afraid of him, so he spent extra time with her, trying to put her at ease. From a social work standpoint, there have been a lot of things happening in our country over the summer, especially involving the public's perception of law enforcement, and I wanted to do something to kind of help create better relationships between our community and law enforcement, Eckes said. I thought we'd start with the kids and create better relationships all around. Most of the kids' questions were about the many things a police officer carries, and Closen pulled out his handcuffs to show one little boy who wanted to see them. Several children were also interested in his gun and pointed out that guns aren't allowed in schools. The sign on the door says, "No guns," Camden Thomas said. Closen chuckled and explained that police officers carry their guns everywhere, and the sign isn't meant for them. But he had no intention of removing it from its holster, either. A few kids asked about taking people to jail, and Closen said sometimes police officers do have to put the bad guys in jail, but they don't like having to do that. It's necessary to keep everyone else safe, he said. You know, children hear a lot, so what a perfect way to see a police officer in a school, in a casual atmosphere, having breakfast with them and having conversations with them, Principal Tanya Young said. I think it's the beginning of a good partnership. Hamilton inspires Milliken Constitution Day talk by Justin Kahn, H&R staff writer. Decatur. As Milliken Associate Professor of History Dan Monroe started listing off the qualities that made the life of Alexander Hamilton such a fascinating story, he said, "That sounds like a movie." It likely will be soon. Hamilton's unlikely rise from orphan to one of the authors of the U.S. Constitution before being killed in a duel by Vice President Aaron Burr has suddenly become pop culture, thanks to Hamilton, a musical, written by Lin-Manuel Miranda. The success of the musical led Milliken's Department of History and Political Science to host Alexander Hamilton, the Man Behind the Musical, on Tuesday as part of its Constitution Day celebration. Constitution Day was September 16th. His story has everything: sex, violence, political conflict, inspiring beginning, and a tragic end, Monroe said. Milliken lecturer of political science Amber Lusvardi said she was skeptical when students first told her about Hamilton, but once she began listening to the songs, she was hooked. When it came time to pick this year's Constitution Day presentation, Lusvardi said, I felt like it had to be Hamilton. The musical is what helped bring Milliken alumnus and recent retiree Dan Allen to the presentation. I didn't know a lot about Hamilton, but I've become more and more intrigued with the popularity of the musical, Allen said. Lusvardi began the presentation in Schilling Hall, room 418, to about 45 people with Hamilton's backstory, how his mother, Rachel Fawcett, came to give birth to two illegitimate children on a remote island, then orphan Hamilton and his brother James, after succumbing to fever in 1768. Hamilton, though, eventually moved to the British North American colonies, attended college, and served in the Revolutionary War, and was the first U.S. Secretary of the Treasury under President George Washington. Monroe spoke about Hamilton's political philosophies, including his dislike of democracy. He had a pessimistic view of human nature. He believed that most people's principal motivations were their own self-interest, Monroe said. But, Monroe said, Hamilton's belief in a strong federal government was influential in the U.S.'s early success and ability to survive the Civil War. Then Monroe turned the presentation back over to Lusvardi, saying, It's a gloomy ending. All good movies have one. Luce Vardy set the stage for Hamilton's deadly duel with Burr by pointing out that Hamilton had actually spoke out against duels before and after his son had died in one. But Hamilton had a heated rivalry with Burr, and when Hamilton refused to apologize for his disparaging dinner party remarks about Burr that had appeared in a newspaper, it ended with Hamilton dead and Burr still the vice president under President Thomas Jefferson. Burr was a genuinely bad guy. It's a blessing he didn't become president, Monroe said. We owe Hamilton for that, too. Appeals Court denies Gill ballot spot by Dan Petrella, H&R Springfield Bureau Chief. Springfield. A federal appeals court has denied requests from David Gill that could have allowed the Bloomington physician to appear on the November 8th ballot as an independent candidate in the 13th Congressional District. The U.S. 7th Court of Appeals on Tuesday declined to reconsider a three-judge panel's earlier action blocking Gill from the ballot, or to quickly grant him a hearing on his case. After U.S. District Judge Sue Myerscough ruled late last month that Gill should appear on the ballot despite not having collected all of the 10,754 signatures he needed on his nominating petitions, the appeals court halted her order. The Illinois State Board of Elections, which had previously certified the ballot with Gill's name on it, voted unanimously Monday to formally remove him. Sam Conman, the Springfield attorney representing Gill in the case, said they're still studying the appellate court's order, which he believes may have left the door open for future court action between now and Monday. Ballot access appeals are ordinarily expedited, so treating this as a standard appeal, which would yield a ruling after the election and therefore be moot, would be unusual, Conman wrote in an email. Gill, who previously ran for Congress four times as a Democrat, collected nearly 8,500 valid petition signatures. He filed a federal lawsuit challenging the state's signature requirement for independent congressional candidates because his would-be opponents, U.S. Representative Rodney Davis, Republican from Taylorville, and Democratic challenger Mark Wicklund of Decatur, each had to collect fewer than 740. With Election Day drawing nearer, Gill's options may be running out. Local election authorities must have absentee ballots prepared to mail to military and overseas voters by Friday. Gill still could ask the U.S. Supreme Court to step in and overrule the appeals court, an option Conman said he's still weighing. Barring that, he has until a week before the election to notify local election authorities in the 13th District, which stretches from Champaign County to the Mississippi River and includes parts of Bloomington, Normal, and Decatur, that he wishes to run as a write-in candidate. Ex-National Guard soldier given 30-year prison sentence. Chicago, Associated Press. A Chicago federal judge on Tuesday sentenced a former Illinois National Guard soldier and his cousin to prison for plotting to join Islamic State fighters and to attack a U.S. military facility. Hassan Edmonds, 23, the former soldier, was sentenced in U.S. District Court to 30 years in prison. His cousin, Jonas Edmonds, 30, received a 21-year prison sentence. The sentences matched what prosecutors asked for the men, both residents of suburban Aurora. Hassan Edmonds devised a plan to travel to the Middle East while Jonas Edmonds attacked the National Guard Armory in Joliet, according to prosecutors. The goal, prosecutors say, was to kill as many as 150 people at the facility. Jonas Edmonds said he dropped Hassan Edmonds at the airport to travel to the Middle East to join Islamic State fighters. But Jonas Edmonds denied he would have attacked the military armory. The person they're trying to make me into, I'm not that person, Edmonds told U.S. Judge John Lee. Defense attorney James Graham told the judge that Edmonds was a heavy smoker of marijuana and was boastful, but had no weapons and would never have gone through with the attack. It was a characterization that was dismissed by Assistant U.S. Attorney Barry Jonas, who noted as he held up a duffel bag filled with National Guard uniforms that Edmonds planned to don the uniform to help him blend in and gain access to the armory for the attack. Thank God the FBI was there to stop him, Jonas said. Man punches wall, Decatur. Angry because his girlfriend refused to get out of bed, police said a Decatur man began punching holes through the wall of her home with his fists early Sunday. Sworn statements said the suspect, 41, wanted the girl and mother of two of his children to get out, and she did not want to. The suspect allegedly punched three large holes in the bedroom wall of her home before throwing a lamp that hit her in the face, throwing a drink over her, and punching another hole in the wall by the front door. The apartment is a Decatur Housing Authority residence, and police said the damage will cost more than $500 to repair. The suspect was jailed on preliminary charges of domestic battery and criminal damage. Lincoln man rescued from trench in Decatur. By Danette Beckett, H&R staff writer. Decatur. Steve Givens, 56, of Lincoln, was airlifted to HSHS St. John's Hospital in Springfield for treatments of injuries he suffered after being trapped in a trench for nearly 3 hours. Decatur Fire Chief Jeff Abbott said his department was dispatched at 7:30 a.m. after reports of a man trapped up to his waist in a dirt-filled trench. Givens was an employee of Autobahn Contractors, preparing a site for the Decatur Sanitary District off of McDonald Avenue, south of Hickory Point Mall. According to Autobahn Contractors Division Manager, the accident occurred when Givens was walking between two work areas. He stepped into a ground pocket below the excavated area and was swallowed up to his waist. During the fall, his leg became pinned behind him. The area was surrounded by loose soil, making the rescue difficult. More than 20 emergency personnel from area departments worked to stabilize the ground before two vacuum trucks were called to extract the debris. As the trucks began sucking up the dirt and water, more debris caved in around him up to his shoulders. The fire department then utilized both vacuum trucks at the same time, enabling them to pull Givens from the trench. Givens was alert throughout the incident. His injuries were not considered life-threatening. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half of today's Herald and Review. Please stay tuned.